the devil awakens.
Maximus wrests his life from the underworld.
Hey boy, what in the world are you doing here?
He was elated with his escape.
I wanted out.
I set out now in a box upon the sea.
I've been thinking a lot about what it means to come to form, what it means to find a form, how long that takes, how many years, decades one goes through trying to figure out what you're doing and how you get there. And I just want to start with a couple of the thoughts that had come out of the proprioception event. And I'm going to kind of throw a couple of very heavy, dense, complex things at you that some people may not be like, what the hell are you talking about, you know? But those of you who are here may have some sense, and I'll try to explain it. But I'm trying to get at why form is so important. And I was listening to one of the things that we talked about in preparing for that event was there was a quote that I had used in my bit that I talked, which was from Charles Olson, where he said, archaeological discoveries of the past centuries have supplied directly from the ground substantive and narrative physicality to previously discursive language and thought. Okay, so the key here is physicality, providing a physical actuality to things that had just been, you know, terms, okay? Now, I was listening to back when a lot of us first got together of the proprio people, and just so the people here at the Writers' Center know, we're planning, you know, proprio summer camp for the next 10 years, so prepare yourselves. I was listening to Chuck Stein's talk, and at one point in his talk, he says, the organs slung in the body are the archives. And I was like, whoa, wow, okay. The organs slung in the body are the archives. So thinking about that, I began to think about how, you know, my work is a constant mapping, constant process of mapping. And like people who, you know, people who move as dancers or choreographers, people who paint the similar objects or similar times of day or similar patterns of color, come back again and again and again in a different context to those things. And what I had written, you know, you keep going at the same moments from very different perspectives. You keep going at the same moments from very different perspectives, so the work kind of becomes prismatic. You know, you just twist a little bit, everything shifts, everything changes. And then you're mapping not only the coming to consciousness of things, but in proprioceptive terms, of the location and composition of the soul material, okay, the actual soul material, which is distributed through the body and has a cellular memory that responds to changing environments. Okay? So just accept that for the time being. I'm gonna try to clarify it as we go along. Yeah. And you know, I just want to mention, you know, these conversations are going on, have been going on in a variety of ways. They started with, you know, well, I'll talk more about that as we continue. Okay, you keep going at the same moments from very different perspectives, so the work becomes prismatic, and a mapping not only of the coming to consciousness, but in proprioceptive terms, of the location and composition of the soul material, which is distributed through the body and has a cellular memory that responds to changing environments. Okay? So, now let me simplify things a little bit. I'm now I have these weird anniversaries this year. I have coming up in the fall, actually, weirdly, a conference on me. On 20 years after my book, After Jews and Arabs, which came out in 1993. And also coming out sometime in the fall is a new edition of my book, From the Warring Factions, 10 years since it was first published, and it's been out of print for about 8 of those years. And this is that book, and I'll pass it around. That photograph is the house where we lived, right across from the studio, down on Rocky Neck. And you might recognize that. That's our family 51 Hudson and my baby carriage in the garage. So I've been thinking a lot about the fact that my last two books, some of which you may be familiar with, Islanders, ostensibly a novel, and Neither Wit Nor Gold, which is a curious mix of poems, notebook pages, photographs, jottings, are actually based on really old work. They're based on work primarily done from around 1973 to about 1978. And these are my most recent books. Okay, so I want to try to kind of take a little bit of a journey there, read through some things and try to figure out why that is and how that came to be. And part of it for me has to do with, again, mapping and thinking about, well, let me just, I was on the subway a couple of weeks ago. I meant to start with this and I forgot. And I got one of those great found poems. Two signs right in a row. The first one said, "Are you depressed?" And the second one said, "Expect more from self-storage." So, you know, all of this work is self-storage. Now, the question is, can you expect more from it or not? You know, and what can you expect from it? And how do you figure out what it is? And so, you know, one of the things that comes up is kind of like, what do you take on and why do you take it on? You know, what's the scope of what you take on? And it seems to me some of that has to do with circumstances, but I think some of those circumstances are very, actually in a strange way, superficial. And what I mean by that is, having grown up in a family where my parents were immigrant refugees, who the extended family spoke a whole bunch of different languages. You know, there was common to have kind of Nazis around the dinner table as proverbial presences, you know, just as, you know, those are the people that they had escaped from. You know, that throws a certain kind of, shall we say, you know, burden or a different scope onto what one might take on, okay? But I have felt that, you know, it took me some, you know, 20, 25 years to work through that and understand that maybe that's really on the surface in a lot of ways, that maybe that's on the surface, that everybody has these layers in different you know, in different ways, and they may be actually more difficult to get to if they aren't so apparent, if they aren't so different, if they aren't so pronounced, like another language or another culture, or things like that. So, for instance, I mean, I was looking through a bunch of things to figure out, you know, what I was going to read, and you know, I for instance, here's a text that was written in, I don't know, the early 90s, I guess. And it begins with this paragraph. Not even this paragraph, but these sentences. It's called My Mediterranean, and it was written while I was living in Jerusalem. My Mediterranean began on the Atlantic coast, first frontier of the New World, in a fishing city called Gloucester, settled by Portuguese immigrants. Whenever I was sad, I would ask my mother to take me up to the Church of the Fishermen, high on the hill, majestic in blue and stucco, with its two open bells ringing in the tide. Gloucester also meant the Greeks, cool drinks at the Anassus Luncheonette, seedless grapes hanging abundantly off the white arches across from the movie theater at the Kachopoulos Market. Boston and my father's sweet tooth led us to the Syrian and Armenian quarter. later Atlantic Avenue in New York meant the cassettes of Fairuz and Farid al-Atrash. Okay, right there at that point, I'm entering into a realm of things that are less personal. Things that are less personal, that are not coming directly out of my own early experience. And the rest of the text goes into things that are much more what I would call kind of cultural counters, you know, cultural counters, things that I could negotiate with, use for one reason or another. And I've been really interested in investigating how you either use those things up, or they really become internalized, or you absorb them into some other kind of writing. And at a later point, as I'm talking, we're going to get to a point where I feel like I was able to absorb all this cultural material on a cellular level in terms of words themselves, in terms of actual words themselves that become rhythms and become parts of rhythms rather than things you can point to and say that's a that or that's a this or that's a this kind of thing or that kind of thing. Is this making or sending my poems to Vincent from when I was 13, 14? And I realized being in this building, being in this house, 126 East Main Street, Gloucester, Mass, was the address that I was most used to writing or typing over a period of probably 7 or 8 formative years. That was the address that I was, you know, it was a couple of letters a week back and forth to Vincent, 126 East Main Street, Gloucester, Mass. And I don't remember when zip codes came in. Does anybody know when zip codes came in? But when did they come in?
Late 60s.
Late 60s. Okay, so I think zip codes had already started, probably 69. And I was just thinking about that as, you know, a physical memory. And, you know, what the qualitative difference of that kind of physical memory is at certain formative periods to things that come at different periods, and how one negotiates those changing qualities of things over time. So, anyways, just to give a little bit of a schematic here in terms of my own work, I have 3 books that are quote unquote, you know, poetry, prose, combinations thereof, which I really think of as composing a sequence in some sense, or at least responses to or continuations of. And the first one is called The Cairo Notebooks, which came out in 1993, and I forgot a copy. The second one is From the Warring Factions, which I passed around, and I'm going to read one part from later, which came out in 2002 and was actually finished in August of 2001. And the third one is called Scrap Metal, which came out in 2007. Okay, so those are those. And then there's Islanders and Neither Wit Nor Gold that I mentioned. Now, I'm bracketing a tremendous amount of work that I did, political writing, journalistic writing, scholarship on the Middle East, after Jews and Arabs, and a whole bunch of other stuff, and a lot of translations, books, poems. My main areas of translation were during the war in ex-Yugoslavia. I translated a lot of first-hand material, reports by witnesses, journalistic things, but also poetry and literature. And from the Middle East, particularly the writings of Arab Jews in Hebrew, from Hebrew, and also from Arabic with a lot of help. So that's a tremendous block of effort and of work, and a lot of that folds in, seeps in, finds its way into the other material, and sometimes is, you know, very intertwined with it. And part of what I guess I've been trying to do is, in some sense, you know, almost in a sense, both use and liberate myself from the topical, you know. which is not easy when you're so immersed in it, because you really become it. They become reference points, and they become things that you rely on, and they become things that are important in how you define, you know, where you're coming from, really. So, you know, I think let me read. Let me start at the later end, where I'm using very old material, but slightly reframing it in a way that is commenting on what this whole process has been and what I've been trying to do. And this is neither wit nor gold, which, as I said, the actual writing in here, except for two or three pieces, all dates from the 70s, as well as the photographs which I took, and the notebook pages and all the rest of it. But I did frame this book with two quotes, which I want to say something about. One from Robert Creeley. He writes, "Will it be that someday we come to some relation with those who make up our condition, humans, that will not argue their histories as all that they depend upon for relation, or else, more accurately, that what they do is more relevant to all their lives, one by one or all in all, than what they didn't?" Okay, maybe I'll read that again. "Will it be that someday we come to some relation with those who make up our condition, humans, that will not argue their histories as all that they depend upon for relation, or else, more accurately, that what they do is more relevant to all their lives, one by one or all in all, than what they didn't?" Okay, so for me, this is kind of like, you know, me as the and we talked about this, and Kate mentioned this also in the proprioception thing, you know, the importance of history and all of that. This is like the antithesis of how I would usually present anything. But this quote struck me as being so important and so necessary for me at this point that I used it. And then the following quote is really, you know, much more personal in a way. Jack Kerouac, "All day long wearing a hat that wasn't on my head." And that's, you know, that's really it. I mean, you know, what are you wearing, you know, and for whom? And that really struck me. That struck me very, very deeply. So I want to just read through, skipping a few things, but a few of the things here. And I'll tell you a little bit about them just before I read them. Okay, you've got this photograph, and then there's, you know, notebook page, and then there's this text, which I'm skipping, and then there's a typewritten thing, which is scanned in, more photographs, and then note, and then this group of poems, which I will read, and note, photograph, and I'm going to read up to here. The poems, when you hear them, you will recognize many of the lines in them, because each line is taken from some other poem, which is an ancient Roman method, and it's a method that's also very, very much used in early medieval Arabic poetry and medieval Hebrew poetry, where you know, you really are composing, and it's the context of the lines that you take and what you make with them. And it's actually very different than what now is called conceptual writing. It's very different. I think it's actually the opposite of it, even though the method might seem similar. So anyways, let me just read some of these, and I think you'll get my point. "Rust and time, nor wit nor gold abet the old song's burden. Part prophecy, part longing, the hanging garden, a shadowy dream. The world grows so very old, though once we too were young." Something had happened to the very particles of the substantial, of substance, to the very cup on the dashboard, now not what a cup might have been. The sentences themselves seemingly unable to carry the seed of an untold tale, driving through the words in full force to emerge as told. Caelum non animum mutant qui transmare curunt. Horace. 1. We are pained by fetters of wind around our ankles. Such it is, heart's complaint. Let others freeze with angling reeds. We expected it and shine in the brightness of new paint. Or was there too little said? The dead cannot be told anything. We go slowly. The air is sometimes as shining as ice is. Something is wrong with the antique. Some old Egyptian joke is in the air. Too weak a wash of crimson colors it. The sky changes in ways I did not think of. 2. If you want to say yes in loyalty. All the poets in disguise. At least we both know how shitty the world is. Nothing to believe in except maybe the ships in Gloucester Harbor. The bird sings, its feathers shine. Peace is soon coming, and love of common object. The stone spells a name naming none. The workman dies, and after him the work, some stunning inch of unsuspecting fiber. Men reckon what it did and meant. What this means is that my head is in my hands. The sky changes in ways I did not think of. 3. The moon never beams without bringing me dreams of rock and of dust and of animal hopelessness. I am going north looking for the source of the chill in my bones, in folly ripe, in reason rotten. Days come white or night come black. What instruments are playing and whose eyes are straying? The sky changes in ways I did not think of. A sloop of amber slips away. Where was it? The space, the air displaced. 4. A surf-tormented shore down to a sunless sea, none upon the lashed spars lying quick or dead. No hope of going back, no spot of ground that looked like El Dorado. That which is and that which was, which fight tells what heat there was? The sky changes in ways I did not think of. 5. The sky changes, a benumbing ink that stains the sea of our minds. Our names are left like leaves of grass, human greenness, tough as grass that survives cruelest seasons. Leaf around leaf, ranged around the center, links of dance undone in ways I did not think of. Are facts not flowers, and flowers facts, or poems flowers, or all works of the imagination interchangeable? Time is a shine caught blue from a martin's back. Read these with Diane at the Bowery. First time I'd read them since probably 1976 or so, I mean in public. I'd had a reading, my first, at Rogers' little bookstore on Greenwich, where Corso almost knocked me over once. Read with Tim Dlugos, who I didn't really know, and Ted Berrigan came with him, and they left after Tim read. I remember it being very crowded with friends, all of us, I think, sitting on the floor. Each poem was dedicated to someone, Gil, Dick, Frank and Annie, Emily Dickinson, and Kate. And then there's the Latin from Horace, which I guess I must have gotten from The Sky Changes, Caelum non animum qui transmare, etc. But I'm not sure why I left the last line out. Quod petis hic est, what you seek is here. There was a time we walked these streets without a care, our history within. So that's, you know, that's kind of the punchline, which in a sense, you know, composed itself as I was composing these things in the manner that I was. You know, not really having thought about why I left that last line of the Horace quote out, quod petis hic est, what you seek is here. And then this little fragment, there was a time we walked these streets without a care, our history within. So, you know, it becomes that point of how do you, you know, the relationship of something that is conscious to the ability to perform it unconsciously. The ability to perform it, to inhabit it, or to enact it in some way, unconsciously. And I guess let me say this. What I found, and it took me a long time to figure it out, what I found was that in these books that I mentioned, the Cairo Notebooks from the Warring Factions particularly, I had these blocks of prose that were very old that I kept putting in there. They kept sticking them in there. I didn't know why. I mean, they had no real relationship to the context of those books, but I just kept putting them in there. And they seemed very necessary for me, and it took me a long time to kind of figure out what I was doing. And I articulated that in several places. I mean, one actually... one in this afterword that I had written for Circles and Boundaries, Kate's book, where I talk about how each piece becomes an experiential instance, of something, okay? And how the works are site-specific, but the sites vary greatly. And so I began to think about my work through encountering this work as site-specific, in a sense, time-specific, vocabulary-specific, and how that, you know, what that said about what it was trying to do or what its relationship was to previous things. And I think it was only really with the problem that I set for myself in From the Warring Factions, which is a book dedicated to the massacre at Srebrenica in Bosnia, in which some 7,000 Muslim men and boys were massacred in 1995. I realized that if I was going to somehow encounter that incident, that all the work in the book had to be appropriated, had to be not mine, or had to be, in other words, I had to set the words up in such a way that, I'm trying to explain this in some way. I mean, I've explained this many different times, but I think I'm leading on to something different here. To backtrack, in the Cairo notebooks, I used material that I had myself translated, taken from victims of torture. Okay, and I included it in the text and created a kind of amalgam of those accounts of that, and immediately set it off by a narrator who is mundane. I mean, the narrator wakes up, his shoulder aches, you know, something's going on. So there's a very radical disjunction between the account of these victims of torture and the narrator. And I realized when I got to this material regarding Bosnia, both for personal reasons and for the material itself, I somehow had to find other words. I had to use other words. So the book, it's in five books, five sections, and each book really is a different linguistic climate. So the book four, for instance, which I'm going to read, it sounds like, you know, I'm going to read you an epic, but it's pretty quick, uses all American words. And the reason for that is I realized I couldn't be dealing with this material if I wasn't also implicating myself, if I wasn't also implicating the place that I am from, the place of this continent, the, you know, massacres that have been perpetrated here. So throughout the text, Native American material is very, very present. Very, very present. There are a whole bunch of sub-themes that are very present. But the words themselves were all drawn from other texts, and I used word lists and composed out of those word lists the way a painter would use a palette. Painter uses a palette and the colors get mixed. And I was using words in that way. So the words were returning almost to a cellular level. So they could come to represent things, but they were integrated into the text rhythmically. So they had a very different function. And in some parts of the text, there are you know, direct quotes, but most of them are composed of single words, and literally a, the, and. I mean, I just created lists, notebooks, and those were the words I could use. And it was a very curious thing because it comes out to be very lyrical and not, as one would think, you know, artificial. And I just want to read a little thing from this, the new edition, which will be coming out in the fall. I wrote an author's note to the new edition. And this is just a paragraph that I wrote, and then I want to read from that section, and then we can start talking, maybe. At a reading in Vancouver in 2010, I talked through some of these ideas about narrative, what the probing of evidence about one's past selves might yield, and used the figure of memory ballasts, anchors to a more distant past that I had dropped at various places in my work and had been going back, not necessarily to retrieve, but see why I had left there in the first place. Okay, so not necessarily to retrieve, but see why I had left them there in the first place, and as well, recalibrate them, shift the prism. I was struck by a response from poet and novelist Daphne Marlatt. Quote, "There seems to be a lot of motion, a lot of movement. You're using long sentences. That's what it sounds like. It's what gets caught up in a sentence that generates the narrative. It's what gets caught up in a sentence that generates the narrative." Do you want to sit somewhere? Oh, okay.
Say that again, will you?
Yeah. "There seems to be a lot of motion, a lot of movement. You're using long sentences. That's what it sounds like. It's what gets caught up in a sentence that generates the narrative." And then I end that with, "Beyond the expected imperatives that political life is inextricably bound to possibilities of expression, to what gets called so generally culture, removed from worship, rites, or tillage, what remains is an ongoing struggle with form, with what something turns out to be and how it gets to be that way, to move from the obviously historical to the less obviously historical, to situate ourselves in time and understand how we got here, to find what is ours in order to disown it. That movement is the story, and an essential part of the task that From the Warring Factions sought and seeks again to engage." Okay, and let me read you this section, and I want to tell you something, if I can retrieve my book, which is wandering around somewhere. Thanks. Okay. Okay, book four. I don't know why I decided to read this, but it kind of makes sense here. I hope. It's four, it's called Borrowed Time, and I'm just going to read, in the back I like to work pretty transparently, I just kind of say what I used. And let me just say something about some of the materials that appear in this book four. The title of the fourth section, Borrowed Time, the Hannah Arendt phrase, where she says that we are all now living on borrowed time, comes from her On Revolution. Again, part of the, just in the choice of the quotes here, because the title is from Hannah Arendt, Borrowed Time. The first quote is from Phyllis Wheatley, who, as you know, was an enslaved person who was a poet in the 1700s, and the next quote is from Franz Boas. But I was also thinking about the difference, you know, putting right up front the difference between people brought to this continent voluntarily or involuntarily, and what the implications of that are. Okay, the title of Force. Okay, the words in this section are American, even though some, such as Arendt's and those of Phyllis Wheatley and others, come from people transported to these shores, voluntarily or in chains. In this section, the dispossession of those who have gone to war comes out clearly, alluded to earlier in the text with the Roman sources, now through the stories of veterans, particularly the Navajo code talkers who waited so long for the state to recognize what they had done. Material here includes words from John Wieners, the Book of Daniel Drew, the Pequot convert William Appice, Langston Hughes, Ralph Ellison, James Baldwin, Duke Ellington, Sidney Bechet, Yusef Lateef, Sun Ra, Melvin Tolson, the 1847 narrative of William Wells Brown, a fugitive slave, the African-American whaling captain William A. Martin, Tecumseh, William Henry Harrison, and the artist Jess. Okay, so there's all that in here and more. This shouldn't take too long. Four, borrowed time. 'Twas mercy brought me from my pagan land, taught my benighted soul to understand. Phyllis Wheatley, 1768. It is most unpleasant work to steal bones from a grave, but what is the use? Someone has to do it. Franz Boas, June 6th, 1888. This vast machine, its transient sweetness expectant, the acts recovered when action ceases and ideas range, in due order we see the long forgotten years, long departed, all their cunning, all their strength, all their force, more guarded. The owl seeks the caves of night in sadness, the unbounded regions of the mind, the land of errors which wanton tyranny with lawless hand had made, of wrongs and grievance unredressed, till nature leave the earth behind, and place itself would rise and o'erspread the lands beneath, and learn to imitate her language there. Bright jewel, final wreck, fatal scepter, I strive to comprehend. Even the most commonplace objects seem to have some bearing on his destiny. The word lure, rebel for blues or stripers. The shift from fresh air to our political atmosphere, like the miner's canary, not a grant of rights to, but a grant of rights from, a reservation of those not granted. As the snow melts before the sunbeam, a sketch in red crayon, the good name of our country, mica, volcanic glass, chalcedony, conch shells, shark teeth, copper. Like loosely gathered rope flung across open water from boat to boat, their memories, it can now be asserted, were authentic. Inhaling the smell of antiseptic and the stench of bedpans, listening to the mumblings of the dying, lying in bed, watching the beautiful boats. To a man, they said, they were disappointed. He couldn't remember if they had thrown pebbles or sand at each other. He saw her legs for a second, then again as they appeared under a chassis or through a door. He played with her on the swings across the street from the garage. The swing she flew off as she ran across the field, telling him she'd beat him to the junkyard. He chased her over through the white fence across the street, past the gas pumps and the air hose, trudging through the mud by the tin shacks whose doors rattled and swung in the wind all the way to the yard filled with ancient, smashed cars. She ran through them, opening doors, jumping across hoods and roofs, taunting him with sand or pebbles. Glass crunched and doors rattled as he landed running, sand hitting hollow fenders as it crumbled and spread to the ground. Past a tall fence, the field opened up to a lush green where the brook turned into a river. She jumped the fence and he chased her through the tall grass, up a dirt road, through some woods in someone's yard, where she fell to her back in the moist, thick growth and laughed at the sky. He stood at a distance and watched her until she sat up and looked at him. He walked over and sat next to her. They stayed there, watching each other and an old man stepping out of a shack to feed his chickens across the river. This is not paralysis by any means, but a kind of shock. The intention of being suspended or lying dormant, an adhesion, an appearance, something not completely palatable like earth and dirt, the sweetness and the ash. Thin layers of silt and mud like quicksilver joining and splitting plains lined by rows of stranded rocks, ancient shorelines jutting out into the uneven retreat of glacial ice, a kind of paradise of walnut or cedar or chestnut and stones to strike fire, fish and fur, oak and ship timbers, spars and masts of white pine, iron made from ore raked from the floors of coal bogs, the wilderness a clear resemblance of this world, kernels of corn in the ear of a crow. Here were the flowers, prairies by the sea, the music as of old, set like jewels in the green expanse. Unite yourselves with us in size and grandeur. Seek the plentiful harbor. Diligently collect history written in bone. Examine these earliest artifacts, the first examples, the last vestiges. Keep the continent from being blank, a place of imprisonment, dumb with the question. 4/7 of agricultural production taken over, corn carried on their back, 70 miles, one of the first desperate years, as a gift long before anyone assumed we made a mistake. Stake in trying to bear witness, all this wonder, all this newness, the body wrapped in bark, the vessel polished with the tooth of a beaver, a gift from the departed, smoked in a lobster claw, alders, lichen, bloodroot, and sumac. How we played, compelled and blind, our claim no emptier than questions of industry and idleness, survivors of our expectation, the law of the land recollected carefully in the hollow, the ambition to come to meaning before inquiry, the itinerant faces of defeated ancestors crop up again, adrift. Think of their names like our hands, shadows at the bottom of the sea. Something like soul that you are witness to, that you remember by experience, by surfaces, some great, great wound in the whole body, so unwieldy, so completely irretrievable, no one dares operate. How long ago we walked unwinding the jewels there on the meadow of yellow flowers, on the meadow of blue flowers, under the growing corn we used to sit, the blue flowers woven over the yellow ones, the place which is called black spot with life, the place which is called blue spot with life, the white circle in the sand, this gold, the emblems, these waters claim your boat, the irises you grasp, a deceit you cannot name now, this tension shattering the sacred place, the slaughter we live by, trying to remember as rocks are ground to powder and made into blocks. The ghost of the pain is the circle of wild horses. The price of freedom isn't cheap, the sergeant said. People could at least invest a little time. They are old men now, drifting into town in their boots, blue jeans, and silver buckles. Like other aging veterans, they meet once a month on Saturday mornings for a blend of poignant and prosaic duties, planning parades, dispersing money for the funeral expenses of one old comrade and a small scholarship for the son of another, and reviewing the coffee budget, $21.69 this month. But more than 50 years ago, the 15 men in the Chamber of Commerce Hall by the railroad tracks fought fiercely for the flag of a country they had given their people nothing but grief. And the embroidery on the battered red and yellow caps covering their grizzled heads and tanned faces proclaims their proud name. A dream, muffled and dumb, memories of the hanging gardens, the bird, part prophecy, part longing, the waters sure, the stones and trees insensible, their leaves of green, of red, of yellow things, long since fled, the hunter and the deer, the posture that we give the dead, a painted bowl, arrows with a head of stone, painted chief and painted spear, this charm, my garments, the city where I hope to dwell like trash, not silk, the streets transparent gold, imprisoned, lightning, silent lips astride the marketplace of war, where death and glory meet ancient rage and old despair, their beauty and their strength, their parts, their ports, their pomp, call back some time now past, the fatal rhythm of their tread, your own rehearsal, revisiting the congregation like wasted strangers, as if they were alive without record in their own language, speaking some simple word of treasure, next time when all of these are gone. When I thought of all this paraphernalia of American democracy behind me and the project of liberty before me, slavery with its democratic whips, its republican chains, its evangelical bloodhounds, experienced in the knowledge, punctual in measuring, let them feed on this ground, observant of these heavenly lights, like an unaccustomed ghost that starts, surprised, to stumble over graves, the names of people once numerous. A vessel carried away a great number of our surprised Indians in the times of our wars to sell them for slaves, but the nations whither she went would not buy them. Finally, she left them at Tangier. There they may be, so many as live or are born there. An Englishman, a mason, came thence to Boston. He told me they desired I would use some means for their return home. I know not what to do in it, but now it is in my heart to move, Your Honor, so to mediate, that they may have leave to go home, either from thence hither or from thence to England, and so to get home. Do not feel badly because you have lost sight of this daylight. No matter how hard I try, nothing happens to you alone. Those who have reached the place where death stands waiting have not pointed out a way to circumvent it. I myself grieve when I look back there into the past. It is enough to make anyone ponder. Now, here at last, we are ready to end this. When you start to leave, you must not think back with regret. You always return, garment of brightness, wilderness, in the midst of plenty. Farewell, bright moment, lingering sun. This heart will never awaken. Thanks.
I set out now in a box upon the sea.